This is Brennan and Bethany with Theralink Podcast. We believe that a strong therapist-parent connection is essential for therapy success. Join us each episode as we create a community that demystifies therapists and empowers parents.
Today, we're excited to have Kim Selinger join us. Kim Selinger is a pediatric speech-language pathologist at UNC Children's Hospital. While her role is primarily inpatient care, she also helps cover the NICU developmental follow-up clinic and works closely with the outpatient feeding team. I met Kim when we worked together in pediatric private practice. She is a great collaborator with parents and colleagues. Let's get to the interview. All right. Thank you so much for coming, Kim. First off, will you just tell us a little bit about your area of specialty and what you do?
So I'm a pediatric speech language pathologist, but I work in the children's hospital, which means that I do a lot of feeding and swallowing treatment and evaluation. I see kids outside of feeding and swallowing for things like brain injury or changes in communication related to a medical illness or general deconditioning causing feeding and swallowing disorders. So my caseload includes kids in the NICU all the way into PICU and the children's floors. So we will accept kids up to 21 years old, but most of my caseload is in the 0 to 10 range, aside from our brain injury patients. My expertise is primarily within the feeding and swallowing realm, and I really love it. I think it's a whole subset of speech therapy that many people aren't familiar with.
Great. No, Kim, I appreciate that background. From my perspective, so I'm a parent of a child with dysphagia, and I know that as we were learning the extent of his challenges, it could really be overwhelming at times. And I was just curious, what's your approach to addressing families, particularly in the hospital? How do you address those situations, address concerns that families have?
So the hospital is a very overwhelming place, and everything is changing so fast. So what I like to do is take it one step at a time. I talk to the family. What's your goal? Where do you see your child right now? How are they compared to their baseline when they're not in the hospital? And what can we do to support you in getting them to the place that you envision them at? I try to include the family in all of the care planning, making sure that whatever plan I come up with is going to be something that can translate to what's done at home and something that it is of quality to the patient, to the child. You know, we come across people from all different backgrounds and all different perspectives on feeding. And I like to try to tailor the feeding plan to that family and to their needs and to their desires, because it is such a social, it's like feeding and swallowing are for nutrition and hydration, but it's such a social part of our lives. So we like to keep that in mind, how important it is to people.
I love that. That is so true, to keep in mind the social and the cultural aspects to feeding, because you have to really be a listener and a watcher. So people don't even realize that the way they eat at home is different from other people. Mm-hmm. So you have to ask a lot of probing questions, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
All right. I've got a really fun therapist question, because I love to know what tools everybody has. So I bet you're not walking around the hospital with your therapy bag. A lot of therapists have like the bag in the back of the car where you could do therapy anywhere. I've done therapy in a parking lot. I've done it all. But what do you keep in your scrub pockets that you walk around the hospital with all the time?
So my big things for the babies, aside from the bottles, which I use a Dr. Brown system because they offer bottle nipples that meet all the different needs of the kids in our hospital. I think there's lots of other great systems out there. It's just one that the hospital can buy to serve our large, broad population. But the other big thing for our babies is a swaddle blanket.
Really?
And you might be able to appreciate
that. I know. I wasn't expecting that.
Because It's for state regulation and containment, and our babies feed better when they're having trouble figuring out what to do with their mouth and how to coordinate suck, swallow, and breathe, when they don't have to worry about all those other parts of their body because they're nice and calm and cozy in their swaddle blanket. That is huge.
I wasn't expecting you to say that.
So I use that for, that is like, anytime I walk into the room and the nurse or the parent is getting the baby's diaper changed and getting ready for feeding, they're like, do you want them like unswaddled so they stay awake? I'm like, absolutely not. Swaddle that baby because they're going to perform better.
All right. Everyone's going to want to know, do you have a favorite swaddle?
You know, I'm fairly limited to what the hospital can have. Mm-hmm. Personally, I like those copper pearl ones because they're nice and stretchy, but anything mm-hmm. stretchy and, wrappy.
That's awesome.
For our older kids, a lot of this is not actually my feeding tools. It's the things that set them up for successful feeding, such like a tumble form chair, mm-hmm. because I can get nice alignment, nice trunk and head control, mm-hmm. For our spoon feeders. And then
actually, I guess if you don't mind, can you talk about that a little bit more? Cause I think a lot of times, especially those that aren't familiar with working with children who have disabilities, especially speech and feeding disabilities, how important posture is. And I know, like, for my son in particular too, like being supported properly in his chair has been key to getting him the proper nutrition that he needs.
Absolutely.
When he is
so
early.
Beyond the tumble form chair, we use a Rifton oftentimes, which is another supportive seating device. So we want kids in nice alignment. We don't want them having to work so hard to keep their trunk stable. They need to be able to breathe comfortably. And you need to be able to digest. So if your trunk is tipped off to the side, and your head's tipped to another side, it really affects the mechanics of your chewing and swallowing. Mm-hmm. So having to, like, helping support the trunk and the head just makes them, similar to swaddling, like, lets them focus on what their mouth is doing.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's, you know, one of the things that I think oftentimes with, like, care aides in particular, that's something that we've had to demonstrate over and over. And it's something that doesn't always come second nature to folks as they mm-hmm. start working with these.
On that same note, just from a safety standpoint, not being flat on your back, being in a nice, strong, supportive position is going to be an aspiration prevention technique.
All right, Kim, what's a common misconception about therapy or therapists that you wish parents understood?
We have the same goals that you have. We want your child to succeed. And even in those times when it feels like we are taking steps that feel almost backwards or not fast enough, we all have the same end goal. And I think this really shows itself in feeding in the hospital. When I suggest that someone's not ready to eat, it's because I want them to be successful. And I think if we start feeding now, for whatever reason, maybe they're not breathing comfortably, or maybe their body's just too weak, we're going to put them at risk for a setback, where sometimes parents see that as me not wanting to progress their child. But what I really want to do is get them out of the hospital faster. Mm-hmm. Not faster, but safe. Well, faster and safer.
Yeah, I can kind of attest to that firsthand. I know with when we were progressing with feeding with my son, he was at certain points we did have him eating like chopped up bits of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and ultimately he was gagging and choking a lot on it. And the feeding therapist that we had at the time recommended that we then move back once again to purees. And I know that there was a lot of kind of a feeling of being defeated in some ways, because we had felt like we were starting to make some progress. We were moving away from the purees, but then having to go backwards again. And we've even gotten to this step now too, where my son does have a G-tube for additional nutrition, still eating orally, but also gets tube feeds. And, you know, that too was a little bit of a mental hurdle for us to get over, but honestly have found that we've reaped a lot of benefits from it. And it's done a lot to speed up feeding time, reduce stress on us because we know that he's getting the nutrition he needs and then can work on some of those functional aspects with chewing orally. I think in a lot of ways too, that kind of, there's not a lot of representation publicly around feeding disorders and children that have them. There's a lot of things to be demystified around that. Can you talk a little bit, I guess, about like certain types of things that could be done, in your opinion, that would maybe bring this a little bit more to the forefront, invisible for others in the community?
You said it. There's not much representation. I think just having people with all sorts of different needs, different feeding methods, different mobility, just having them mainstreamed into our media. I'm seeing it some in advertisements in places like Target or children's clothing stores, but you don't see the feeding tube, right? So I think just having it out there and knowing that there are going to be questions and there's going to be comments, but being open to, like from our end, being open to talk about it and say, hey, this is just a method of eating. We're not talking about how everyone's getting nutrition to their body. Like introducing this to kids at a young age, normalizing it to them, having them, like, we don't need to pull someone out of a classroom to get a tube feed if everyone else is eating lunch there, right? You don't have to make a spectacle about it and take off someone's whole shirt, but you can sit at the table and have their feed running. And if the kids have questions, they're answered and they move on and everyone just enjoys their meal together.
Yeah. How much collaboration do you get with the nutritionist, dietitian, medical team that's making those decisions about the G-tube?
A lot.
Yes.
So the dietitian is someone I speak with nearly every case, especially when we're coming to the point of potentially talking about a G-tube or any child with a temporary, like an NG tube. We both have similar goals. We see it through different lights and we have to come up to common ground where sometimes the nutritionist will say, you know, this is what their calorie needs are. And I say, well, if you give them 100% of their calorie needs, they're not going to want to eat. So we find a balance where, okay, they get tube feeds overnight. We need a nice long window off during the day so we can work on oral feeding. These are discussions we have constantly.
Do you feel like the outpatient team that you guys work with has similar connection? Because I know when we were an outpatient, we had no collaboration with the medical team.
The nice thing about our feeding clinic is when a patient comes into our feeding clinic, our outpatient clinic at UNC, they are seeing speech, a GI nurse practitioner, and a dietitian all at the same time.
That's great.
So there's like your collaboration right there. So the GI practitioner typically makes sure the patient's comfortable, not having constipation or reflux or GI discomfort. The dietitian manages the nutritional needs, of course, and then the speech therapist with the mechanics and swallow.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between an NG tube and a G tube? And I guess if and when there is a transition from one to the other.
So an NG tube is meant to be temporary. It's non-surgically placed. It's placed at bedside. It's the small tube that goes in the nose right down to the stomach. And it can it's usually taped just right below the nose. And it's meant to be temporary. We sometimes send kids home with them. It's not ideal, but if we feel like, oh, they just need a little bit of time, they need to regain some strength and we're moving off of it, it would be a reasonable thing to consider. And that is ultimately up to the medical team. If they determine that the family's well equipped, the child's a good candidate, it's reasonably safe, and we don't think a G-tube is going to be indicated at this time. The G-tube is a surgically placed tube that goes right into the stomach. It looks like a little button, but essentially the pumps, the feeding pumps that they connect to, work the same. Some of our younger kids who are getting G-tubes placed, and we are not sure that they're going to have them for life, happens quite a bit. When we like to remind parents that a G-tube, while it's a surgically placed feeding tube, it's temporary in the sense that if you are at a point where you have developed your skills and you're able to take your nutrition and your medication, your hydration by mouth, it will come out relatively easily. Yes. So there are a lot of G-tube discussions, and of course they're tailored to each patient and what their prognosis is looking like and their progression, their course so far. But we always, you know, like to say, like, this is a support. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, Brennan, before, we've had so many parents who are hesitant, or it's a stressful decision, but then ultimately relieved because it can reduce hospitalizations or the length of stay for hospitalization. You always know you're going to get your meds. You're always going to stay hydrated. It's a safety net, essentially.
Frankly, that was one of the kind of main selling points for me is my son had battled a couple of infections and needed antibiotics. And when he was initially prescribed amoxicillin before he had the G-tube, it was a battle to get him to swallow it. And with the G-tube, it was no question. One thing, too, I guess, if you wouldn't mind kind of elaborating a little bit on the value or difference between like bolus feeding versus pump feeding. And we've done both. We still do both. We find that it's very situational when we do one or the other. Have benefits with both. But, you know, I guess one of the questions that's come up before with us and our doctor is that there's, with a pump, it does kind of change the rate at which the stomach is digesting. And sometimes that we noticed if we've done a pump for too long, that can have a bit of a negative effect. So we'll go to bolus then at that point in time. Do you have experience with that? Or what have you?
I don't want to risk stepping outside of my scope of practice, but I do see these pumps all the time. In the hospital, we would still consider a pump feeding that's over 30, 60, even, you know, close to 90 minutes, a bolus feeding, not always a gravity feed. But so I see benefits. We often will use longer tube feeds, continuous tube feeds, or long bolus feeds with the pump for kids who are having poor tolerance of volume and need that time to digest, or their stomach just doesn't handle the capacity. In the hospital, honestly, we don't do a lot of gravity feeds where it's just the syringe going in because they like to control everything. So it's just not, that is not something I'm super familiar with just because it's not a practice we use. Although I know many of our outpatient patients do that.
Sure. Yep. Got it.
All right, Kim, what's your favorite part about being a therapist?
I love building the relationships with these kids and their families. In our hospital, we don't always have the families nearby, which, it's hard, but when I have a family and a child that I can just get to know during my time there, it really makes everything worth it. We see a lot of hard stuff. We go through tough things with these families, and it's such a reward to see the kids thrive when they come back for an outpatient visit after a long hospitalization, and we can see them in their true selves when they're feeling great and doing all the things we knew they could do. I mean, that's worth it.
Yeah. I know in our private days, we would see kids sometimes for years. Mm-hmm. So, how is that with, I mean, I'm sure you sometimes only see them for days.
Yeah.
Yep. Weeks. Do you see a lot of the same kids again and again?
So we have some kids who are frequent flyers, right? Mm-hmm. They're in and out of the hospital by nature of their medical conditions. I have some kids where I see one time and I'll never see them again. And that's great for them.
Yes.
I think that's wonderful for them. In the NICU, we have some babies who are born super early and they go home. Some of them go home well past their due date. Some of them are in our NICU for their first birthday.
Oh, wow.
And we get to know them. They've lived their infancy with us.
They come back.
Sometimes they come back just to see us, but we also have our NICU developmental follow-up clinic, our special infant care clinic. And I love covering that clinic because the parents and the baby are out of that stressful NICU environment. And they come back and they've been home and the baby like toddles in or they're pushed in their stroller and everyone's looking refreshed, and you can just see like what this baby really looks like when they're in their home environment.
That's awesome.
And it's nice because there's no pressure. It's not like, oh, we need to finish this bottle so we can get discharged.
You know? Right.
So that's really great.
That's awesome. I know it's always weird when you see a kid that you maybe treated a couple years ago, like out at Target.
Oh my goodness, look how functional they are. Yay. It's amazing. And
yeah.
I really do love, like, if I get to see them, our special infant care clinic usually sees kids up until 2, sometimes 3. But I love seeing them even if they've discharged at age, you know, if they discharge around their due date and I get to see them as like a 1 year old, it's just really,
that's awesome.
Really nice to see.
Yeah, that's awesome. What is one activity that everyone can do at home? I know you have two adorable girls at home. What were you doing at home to feed them as a baby that you knew was going to really help their development that not everybody's doing?
Not stressing about it. I think I did stress about it with my own kids, but if I could go back and tell myself, or maybe I did less with my second one, not stressing about it, especially in those early, just exploring solids phase. It's all new to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's all new tastes. It's all new textures. Listen to what they're saying. Go with the flow and don't stress about it. From a general developmental standpoint, I was thinking about this recently, not from a feeding standpoint, and thinking about the advice I give parents in the developmental clinic. Sing, talk to your child, read to your child, get on the floor and play with them. And what I've realized with my own kids recently is, and my kids in the hospital, is like, we just need to listen to them sometimes, a lot of times, all the time. They're telling us, even from the day they're born, they're telling us things all the time. And if we can really listen to those cues and their the things they say as children or the things they're crying about as babies or how they're responding, it can really shape your interaction with them. And I think as parents and providers and caregivers, we want to impose our knowledge and our care on them without always
listening to what
they need.
You know, the healthcare industry in general right now, you know, what could be done for families who are raising children with disabilities, finding new ways to support these families? Like, from your perspective, what do you think would be something that you would change about the system?
Right now, I'm seeing really a lack of access to care for families. We're in a city where there's quite a bit of resource, but the children who come to the hospital are from all over the state. And I will have kids who have been home for months and months, and they're still waiting on their first therapy appointment. So I think improving that pipeline to getting that therapy going, improving just accessibility in general, making things easier, making it easier for families to get to appointments, and supporting these families with kids who have special needs. We need to make sure that they can get to their appointments. We need to make sure that they can get their formulas, that they can contact their doctors, that they know who to reach out to and when. And I think that's a big hurdle.
Yeah, I agree. I think even just navigating the services that are out there and understanding what's available, there seems to be a lack of like a single repository that people can actually go to. A lot of times it's through word of mouth from other parents that have children that are you know, dealing with a similar condition, or it comes from a therapist, or it comes from a doctor that, you know, here's a resource that's available to you, and it's just not known. So, yeah, I think visibility, awareness around that for sure.
And I think even as a provider, sometimes I'm learning about resources from families, and I write it down, and I'd like to tell other families about it. But on that same front, there's not a home base for me to say, okay, here are the resources that would be appropriate for your family.
Kim, thank you so much for coming. I've learned a ton. I wasn't really expecting that. So I'm really excited.
This was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Yeah.
Do you have questions for our guests? Send your questions to info@theralink.com. You can also find us at our website at theralink.com and on our socials with the handle @theralink.